Session number 766. General Rich on the Siege of Kut. Two nominal 30-minute reels. Possibly segued.
Siege of Kut, reel one.
They're very, I suppose one of the things that most people remember about a siege is the effect on their stomach, that they're very short of food.
Most certainly.
What do you remember in that particular aspect?
Well, we had rather peculiar, because we had 7 weeks of plenty, followed by 10 weeks of adequacy, gradually getting less and less, and finally we had 4 weeks of starvation, which was a complete hell.
Let's start with the plenty. What was that about?
The plenty, well, Townsend always thought he was going to be relieved within 6 weeks. And he just used up his rations in that 6 weeks. And then after the relieving force had failed to get through, he suddenly found out by commandeering all the Arab food and piles of grain and using the mules, he could hold out for another 84 days.
Wasn't it a little improvident of you all to eat most of your food in 6 weeks?
You really couldn't keep it. There's no way to keep it. I mean, we the men were in Arab houses. We were also living in Arab houses, just mud about 4 inches thick with a roof of palm leaves. There was nowhere to keep anything.
Let's talk about the time. What do you say, 4 weeks of absolute hell?
Can you tell me
something about that?
Well, the first thing is that you hadn't got enough in your stomach. And second was that you get very tired of meat by itself. It tastes like a bit of chewed tin in the end. And four ounces of bread is about 3 small slices. And that's got to last you 24 hours.
What kind of meat was it?
By the time we got to the end, the bread was all barley with a lot of sweepings from where it had been stored and quite a bit of the stone grindstones in it.
What about the meat?
The meat was good. There's no doubt that mule is quite good, better than horse.
Have you tasted mule since the Siege of Kut?
No. Nor have I tasted horse either.
How did you go about killing the mules and then cooking it?
That I can't tell you, but it would have been killed by the butchers of the supply detachment in Kut.
Did it ever put you off thinking that you were eating mule?
Never me, no. I was too hungry.
Were you hungry? You say you were too hungry.
Oh, yes, we were hungry. You can't get away from that. People would eat all sorts of things. If you want a little anecdote, I'll tell you one. This was a battery sergeant major, written by a major in artillery batteries. He said, our battery sergeant major arrived with a haversack full of crushed oats. It was meant for horses, it was bad, and it was the sweepings. But with the aid of a penknife and a couple of hours, we got off enough grain to say we'd had porridge the next morning. It was terrible, but it was food. And that's about, I think, what is the sort of general outlook on it. Food.
Do you find people's characters changing under that kind of condition, when they are hungry and when food is at a premium and very short?
That's a very hard one. I can only talk of my own regiment, when we said we were 4 officers, 5 officers who'd been there before the war. We were all very good pals, and such thing never entered into our heads. And I never heard of much of it from other units.
Was it difficult to maintain discipline in the Siege of Kut?
Not where we were. When we were on top of the men. I mean, you couldn't walk a yard without bumping into one of our soldiers.
The siege lasted, what,
147 days? 147 days, yes.
What was the worst part of that siege for you as a young 24-year-old lieutenant?
Well, I suppose the last bit, the hungry days. The rest was just normal shelling and sniping. If you got hit, you got hit. If you didn't, you didn't. And that was the end of it.
Was the bombardment very heavy by the Turks?
At times, yes. But it was mostly directed onto the Kut town itself, where the hospitals were, and they got really by far the worst of the shelling.
Why the hospitals?
Because they were in the middle of the town, and the Turks just loosed off at the town. And, of course, the Red Cross flag that Townsend insisted on the hospitals flying made a very good aiming mark. You couldn't tell it was a Red Cross flag at any distance, but it was an aiming mark.
Did you at any time contemplate surrender?
No, not really. Not till the last two or three days, anyhow.
What were you doing, where were you, when you found out that the siege of Kut was over and that you had in fact
surrendered?
Well,
the first we knew about it was probably the day before, when a staff officer, the only one who ever came over to us in the whole of the siege, came over to say we would surrender next day. And we had orders to smash up and throw into the river every military article, rifle, machine gun and military equipment, except for 20 rifles, a company which we would keep in case the Arabs started looting. And so we spent the rest of that day breaking things up and heaving them into the river.
Were you glad it was over, or do you think you personally could have held out for a bit longer?
Physically, no. We could not have kept on any longer. We were useless, actually, for the last 4 weeks. As soldiers, we couldn't march. I mean, we couldn't have done anything.
How did you spend that time, that 147 days?
Goodness gracious me, don't ask me. Playing bridge, walking round the trenches, sniping the Turks, trying to catch fish in the river, anything.
Did you manage to catch fish in the river?
Well, there was a most revolting mudfish that lived just below the waterline on the bank. I mean, it made you sick to look at it. But if you caught one, we were very glad to eat it.
Did you catch many?
No. The best bait was a dead mouse. So it shows you what they were like.
And were dead mice at a premium in Kut?
Pretty well, yes.
What happened to those?
Well, I think most of them died of starvation.
You had got there, in fact, first.
We got the food first.
Were you, as a young lieutenant, optimistic during that siege of Kut, the 147 days?
I suppose you can say yes. We believed our senior officers in those days. We went in subordinate. And we kept on saying that they would be relieved, and we'd be relieved. And then if it wasn't today, it would be in a week's time. Right up till within 10 days of the end, when the army commander, who was below, said that although the relieving force can't get through at once, it'll get through in 10 days. Well, that 10 days just about took us to the end. It didn't get through. Couldn't, anyhow.
What was your reaction? What were your thoughts when you knew that you weren't going to be relieved, that you had, in fact, been given up for dead?
Well, I think my own, which is all I can give you, because very few people have written about it. I am one of relief, first of all, that and one of the fact we thought we might get some food. And most importantly, we wanted to get into the wide open spaces. When you've been tied round an area about 300 yards by 300 yards for 5 months, we're going to get tired of it. And so I was optimistic, and I thought we'd get food and open spaces.
What did you miss most of all during the time you were cooped up like that? I mean, what did you talk about with your fellow officers when you said, well, when we get out of this, I know just what I'm going to do?
No, I never talked about that. Some of them may. Obviously, some did, because I've read diaries of people who did. But we didn't. I can't remember, let's put it like that, talking about that sort of thing at all.
What's the most vivid impression you're left with now, what, 60 years after the siege of Kut?
60 years, yes. Well, I suppose one of the most vivid impressions, I'm still alive. That's about all. I mean, I was young, able to cope with difficulties, and I found that you could almost draw an age for line and say that below that line, whatever it was, 30 perhaps, it won't affect anyone, and above that line it'll affect everybody. Mind you, it has affected us to a certain extent. We're all slightly dippy, but apart from that, it doesn't matter.
Well, a lot of people would say, I wouldn't certainly describe you as a little dippy. You did, after all, continue your army career and become a major general.
Yeah, so.
I mean, you couldn't have done that if you'd been, quote, dippy, unquote.
No, no, but it is funny. We're all a little bit odd, I reckon.
Odd in what way?
There again, you ask me. Look, I put it this way, personal experience. When I got back to England, I decided that I'd got to do something to get Kut out of my system. I'd saved a certain amount of money. I lived in London and blew it all in about 6 weeks. And I always say that that put me safe. I denied myself nothing.
What did you do when you say you blew it in 6 weeks? What form of...
Wine and women.
Can you just give me a little bit more about that? It's rather interesting.
Yes. Well, I lived in this is very intimate. It doesn't matter. I lived in the... what the devil is called? Piccadilly Palace. Regent Palace Hotel. And I had a more or less permanent room there. And I found a dame who was... or by herself somewhere else, and we just hit it off together everywhere. And then we went to dances, we went to everything, we drank what we wanted, and just really blew the money. And then I had nothing left, and I had to go to the War Office and say I want a job.
But are you saying that in fact saved your sanity?
I said the only time I saved any money as a soldier in Kut, because you couldn't spend the money. And in captivity, you couldn't spend them, nothing to spend it on. So I had what it was probably riches in those days. It would last about a week now. And I just blew it. And I was very glad I did.
What about your brother officers? Did they find the same remedy?
Well, we all disappeared. A certain number of us came into London, and whenever we met, we hit it up again. But otherwise, they dispersed. A lot of them married and went off to their families. And there you are, you just stood, that's all. I can't tell you what other people did. I mean, I met fellows in my own regiment occasionally.
Did you ever meet the dame again?
No.
During the siege, during the 147 days, did you observe the regimental niceties? I mean, did you have mess dinners, or did you just all go into a corner and eat your food on
your
own?
There was no room. We had just that one little mess house and probably a room that two of us shared, and that was all. There wasn't anywhere to go at all, not in our village. And nobody, as far as I know, in the Kut side went in for that. Except possibly Townsend and his staff, but they were much too high for us to take any notice.
So you did just disregard regimental niceties?
Oh, yes. Well, you called, you'd be very careful to be polite to your commanding officer. But otherwise, we had one colonel, and the rest of us were captains and subalterns. In fact, most of us were subalterns, so we didn't need to be respectful except for the one.
Most people regard the English under conditions like this as being rather supreme, always coming out on top, very stiff upper lip, where discipline is the thing that gets them through. Was it discipline, you think, that brought you through the siege of Kut?
In a way, but a background way, guts more than anything else.
I mean, did you have an orderly day? Did you, was it a disciplined day, or did you just...
Oh, no, we had nothing like that. If anyone did anything wrong, which they didn't have much chance to do anyhow, they were just hauled up, dealt with by the company commander or the CO then and there.
How did you spend the day, in fact?
I've not the vaguest idea now. No remembrances at all. Yeah, as a guess, I probably, after a morning meal, we spent most of the morning round the trenches and talking to the men and sniping the Turks and that odd sort of thing, and then we probably went to sleep in the afternoon because the nights were not always quiet. And then we had an evening meal and played bridge.
Was that evening meal always... I'll do that again. Was the one meal of the day, the 4 ounces of bread and the mule meat, always taken in the evening?
No. You really divided it into two, possibly three. You had a morning meal, which would have been one slice of bread and mule stew. You had an afternoon meal, which was a slice of bread and ginger tea, and an evening meal, which was mule soup, mule stew, and any bread there was left over.
How do you make ginger tea?
Ginger was an article, a ration article of the Indian troops, and all you did was to pour boiling water over it. It wasn't very nice, but it was hot.
When you finally got out of Kut, what happened then? I'll do that question again. When the siege of Kut was finally over, what happened to you personally?
I ask you this first. You mean from before we left Kut? Because I'll tell you, I'll go through the whole day and always cut it out. We knew the white flag went up about 11 o'clock. So we then sat about and waited, and in due course, a very well-disciplined Turkish regiment came in with a Turkish major who had a smattering of French. They never looted anything or anybody. They almost appeared to be slightly sorry for it. We sat about. We opened our last mess store, which was a tin of biscuits, and the major produced some coffee, and we had coffee and biscuits. That was the last thing. And then we sat about for the rest of the day until in the late afternoon a Turkish steamer came along and took us up to the place where they were concentrating all the garrison of Kut, about 8 miles up the river.
And you went into captivity, what, on a riverboat?
We stayed in this place, Sumran, for maybe a week, during which time the officers were separated from the men. That's in accordance with the Hague Convention. And we got Turkish rations, which anyone who was foolish enough to eat almost died. They were cast iron biscuits, but you could, if you got them between two stones, hammer them up, soak them in water for hours and eat them as porridge. But a lot of people were so hungry that they ate those biscuits and then got enteritis, and quite a number of them died right away like that. And that's all we got there. And then the relieving force sent up some rations for us, because the Turks couldn't feed us. And we, remember to this day, we had ordered a lot of mess stores to be eaten at Christmas in Baghdad. And they arrived up in this boat, really first-class things, tiptrees, jams, hams, butter. And I was very annoyed. All I could eat was butter and biscuit. And we couldn't carry them away. So anyone who wanted them liable to help themselves. And one or two optimists thought they could carry it away with them, but they couldn't. So we just ate it, and the rest was dumped. I mean, so the British soldiers came along and said, oh, I'll take that, and he put it in something, but by the time he'd carried it 2 miles, it wasn't worth carrying. And then after that, we went up by river steamer to Baghdad, where we were marched through the city. I don't know what the senior officers thought, but the junior officers at the end were very interested. I mean, here, as far as I was concerned, there was the city of Baghdad, and we saw a stork almost at once, so we immediately looked for the houris, and all you saw was a heavily coated black moon or a dashing horseman who turned out to be an old man and a donkey. And they, on the whole, I didn't find much hostility. In fact, the Christian population of Baghdad were rather sympathetic to all. And we went up to the cavalry barracks at the north end where we stayed.
And that's where you spent how many years as a POW?
Oh, no. This is where we spent the first two or three days in Baghdad. You want me to go on?
Yes.
And then from there, we were taken across to the other side of the river to where there was a stretch of 80 miles of railway. The Germans building the Baghdad Railway did all the easy bits first. And it was an easy bit, the 80 miles out of Baghdad. So we went very uncomfortably in a train to a horrible place called Samara, where we spent two or three days under very unpleasant conditions. And then we were told we were to march to Mosul and onwards. And the transport would be provided. The transport was provided. I think it worked out at one small donkey per officer to carry ourselves and our kit. Nothing for the men at all. We had our orderlies with us, but they had nothing. They had to carry. There were a few carts for the senior officers, and just in case someone was sick. And so we marched off on rather in trying circumstances to Mosul, which was about 120 miles away.
During that march or that trip to the POW camp, what were conditions like?
Conditions rarely can be divided into two, officers and soldiers. The conditions for the officers were hard, but no more than that. The conditions for the men were absolutely brutal and hellish. How any of them survived it, I really can't make up my mind, because they were all ill. Everyone was bound to have been ill. Their boots were stolen from them, their helmets were stolen from them, but some got through. Roughly about 70% of the British soldiers and 30% of the Indians died on the march or as a direct result from the march when they got to their camps the other end.
Why was the casualty rate amongst the British troops 70% so high?
I'm guessing probably that the Indians more used to the heat than the British soldier. Although, and you've also got to remember, at that time, at least a quarter of the British force were territorials, almost straight out for England. There may have been 2 months cold weather in India, and absolutely unaccustomed to the thing that the old regular soldier who went out of mess pot with us in the beginning was accustomed to.
What was the main reason, do you think, for that high casualty rate? Was it the heat, disease or starvation?
It was a combination of a lot of things. Combination of starvation and weakness, probably basically. A certain amount of brutality, and nothing else, can't be called anything else, on the part of the escorts.
In what shape was the brutality?
Well, no one was allowed to fall out. Anyone who attempted to fall out was beaten with either with sticks or rifle butts by the mounted escort. And if they...
Can you come forward again? Mm-hmm. When were you aware of the suffering that the men had undergone?
Not really till we got to the prison camps. There were a certain number of officers who were left behind sick in various places, and they came across it firsthand because they were often with parties of soldiers as well, and they went along the route the soldiers went along.
What were their impressions? What were their reports when you all met up again in the POW camp?
Well, we had really a lot of rumours to start with. And then we all had orderlies, and we got some new orderlies who'd been through it. And it was then that we really realised what had happened.
What kind of stories did those orderlies have to tell you?
They were shut up. One place, I can only go there, one place, they were camped on the sea, on the river bank, amongst the rocks. The doctor, Turkish, in charge of them, sold all the drugs to the Arabs. There was nothing to look after them. And the Arab villagers had a very pleasant habit of going up on the hilltop behind and dropping rocks on them. And that happened all the way along, even in a place like Mosul, where a big party of men, I've got a first-hand report of, they, when they arrived, dead tired and dead beaten and pretty sick, they were left in the open for a day, which was not too bad, so they got some food. And at night, they were shut in dungeons, in the fort, well, barracks itself. And they were not allowed out, even for purposes of nature. And as most of them had dysentery, well, it wasn't very pleasant. That is the sort of story you heard. Variations on that theme.
This is one particular aspect of the First World War and the British Army that people don't know a lot about, do they? One hears a lot about the other aspects of the First World War and indeed the Second World War, but why do you think the Siege of Kut and what happened afterwards has remained a bit, what, shrouded in mystery?
The answer is that it was a complete small sideshow. If you want to get your perspective over this, you want to read Winston Churchill's First World War, when the whole of the campaign, from the beginning to the Siege of Kut, which is about 18 months, is dismissed in a small paragraph. And it was worth nothing. It didn't matter what happened to us. There was only one main objective, was to do in Germany. And India, it was an awful muddle to start with. And the Indian government was not prepared to meet an expedition like that in any way. And that really is the basic reason behind it all.
How long did you spend as a prisoner of war?
About 30 months.
And what were conditions like for you as a POW?
As an officer, POW, we started off by going to a very nice, pleasant town about 40 miles from the Black Sea coast, where we were put in houses in which the Armenian inhabitants had just been turned out. We found a certain amount of furniture, and a contractor had been engaged to feed us. But his prices were so high, we had to give him up and fend for ourselves. And then when three officers escaped, we were moved to the only bad prison camp I was in. And I think probably the only bad one in the whole of it. And this was an old barrack, which had been used for cholera, I think, before. We were in the top story. There was no water. The place we were given to cook our food in had been a stable. The whole of the inside of the barrack square was a midden. And we were just plonked there for some 4 or 5 months.
And when you finally, or when the war for you was finally over and you were coming back home, what were your thoughts then, General?
I was very glad it was over. I was then, I'd had various moves all over the place, and I finished up on a place in the railway, Afyon Kara Hissar, which had been a British officer's camp, and I was unattached. We knew there were a lot of officers and men round and away in the country, and three of us decided we'd better stay and see as many of them through as we could, which we eventually did, and then went down to Smyrna, where there had been a hospital ship, and we always hoped someone would come in. Well, the Navy came in, and I and the other two officers, we were then by ourselves, entirely the last, got as far as Alexandria, where the doctor went off to his pals and was looked after very well. The other man, a major, and myself, lived in a hotel in Alexandria. We could get nothing out of the embarkation at all, and so we sat there expecting to get home in about 3 months, and one day the major came to me and said, "We're going tomorrow." He said, "I found a brother Scott who's in charge of a hospital ship, and he'll take us on board." So we just walked on board.